This is a production from the Yak Podcasting Network. The home for your growing sonic map of local voices united in their commitment to the best in podcasting.
And now, a yak.
Yak!
Yak! All right, this is Until the Whistle Podcast. This is Marcus Myers here. I have Jeff Ketchum with me. And this is the inaugural episode, so I'm going to give it a shot here, see how things go.
I think it's cool, man. Like, you know, this, you and I have talked about like how this can go. And I think when I approached you about doing a former players podcast, I thought, A, we need more representation of former players.
Definitely.
Just having a chance to give a voice, have a voice, say what's on their mind. I think sometimes you and I have talked about this. I think it's underrepresented in this market that there's not enough of that. And I think that as you grow comfortable in this role, I think, you know, as the weeks go by, there can be some real fun opportunities in terms of what you can do, who you can bring on this podcast, what you feel comfortable ultimately saying. And I'm dying to shut up and let you talk, because one of the real cool elements of this first podcast is, other than Anwar, nobody else that's done a podcast this week was at the game. You're the only person that went to DC, that did the experience, that, you know. So
you're going to make me relive.
It's therapy. That's what this is. This is therapy. I need to know from a guy who played on a national championship team and went to the game this weekend thinking, okay, this is a step towards something.
Yeah, so the toughest part about it for me is, so first of all, I have some really good friends from college. One of them ran track while he was there, Jonathan Brown, and then a few other guys. And we have our own little Longhorn football group chat, you know, through GroupMe. So it's probably, all together, it's probably like 40 of us in this group chat. And we just get to kind of vent and play, you know, Monday morning quarterback and all of that stuff. But every year we try to find a game to go to. So more times than not, we try to center it around a city where we can have some fun on the side.
Which is why they scheduled this game in the first place.
Yeah, yeah. And so for me, it was really great because I lived in D.C. for 2016. All of 2016, I was there for work. I'm in finance, but I was working for a defense company, and we were headquartered there. So it was kind of like going back home for me. I knew, or not back home, but back to some roots that I had. And so I was really looking forward to it. I still have friends that live in the area. So we had made all these great plans. And then we had started to see like that the weather was going to be kind of bad. So it was like, all right, but, you know, we'll make the best of it. You know, we're big boys. So we got in. Most of us got in either Thursday night or Friday. And so went out Friday night, had a good time. So we used to hang out in the DuPont area, U Street. So we kind of went and checked out some of those scenes. And everywhere you went, you saw Longhorn folks. So, I mean, you would have people that were locals ask us what was going on. And it was kind of cool because, you know, you see somebody else in burnt orange, you know what you're there for.
It was a total takeover.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It seemed like, you know, it seemed like that, especially even walking up to the venue. I had never been to FedEx Field. It's certainly not one of the more modern football stadiums. So I've heard people even describe it as a dump. It wasn't that bad, but I mean, it didn't have all the bells and whistles of
it's a fairly new stadium too.
Yeah, it just doesn't seem like they invested as much into like the fan experience as some of these newer ones do. You know, you think about like what, even, I mean, Jerry World, yeah, it's sky high in terms of pricing, but at least they thought out certain areas for you to be able to like see some of the history and that kind of thing. You know, definitely had areas dedicated to tailgating. This is more just kind of like a big stadium, and then you had a parking lot where people would kind of set up, but it wasn't your typical college atmosphere. So
you guys in your group chat and your traveling party, you guys had expectations coming into this weekend.
Oh, man. So I've been the what's the right word? I'd like to call myself a realist, right? So it's easy for me to get outside of this group of friends that went to other schools that like to bag on me about UT because we've had hard times, but I can always lean back on, well, when I was playing, it wasn't like that, right?
You do have jewelry.
So yeah, that I have something that I can point to that most of them don't. So It helps me in that regard. But I mean, they're right. Like, we haven't been good as of late. I mean, you flat out say we've sucked, you know, and it's tough as a former player because you have like a different connection to it. You know, you've been through some of the ups and downs, you know what it's like, you know what it's like to be on the other side of it. And from my perspective, it's even harder because I was there for some of the best times that we've had, you know, in recent memory. I can literally remember us winning 10 games a year and getting booed, right? Whereas if you were to win 10 games right now, people are getting carried off the field on their shoulders. So I think our group came into the game expecting that we were going to win for sure. I mean, and it wasn't the typical Longhorn arrogance we're going to win, I don't think. It was just there would be enough of a leap from year one to two. There'd be enough congruency along the offensive line. Yeah, you lost Connor Williams, but you have everybody else for the most part back. You have a pretty well-revered offensive line coach coming in. And then more than anything, you know, thinking that the head coach was going to implement some form of an offense that he was kind of known for. Something that, you know, when he was hired on, that's what we thought we were getting, right? You kind of figure, all right, Orlando has the defense figured out. The offense will come out and they'll do their thing. And then the game started. And it was just like, here we go again. And usually I'm one of those real vocal, like I'm yelling type fans. And I just didn't have it in me. Like, I felt like it was zapping the life from me as I was watching this game unfold. Because it was like, this can't be happening all over again, you know? And when the guy kind of took off up the middle on one of the runs and he you know, went in almost untouched, I felt like I was in like deja vu, you know, from last year. Cause I was at the game last year when they lost to Maryland. So it was almost a surreal experience because I was looking down to the sideline in hopes that like you would be seeing some semblance of like an energy or something. And it just wasn't there. And it wasn't that the crowd wasn't there because I mean, we had the place packed out. It was orange for as much as you could see, quite honestly. But it was just that's the best word I can come up with is surreal. Like it just felt like everything that we had been hearing for the past few months, what I had seen out there in the spring, all the hopes that we had for, OK, we're going to see something in this season that's going to show us we're ready to take that leap. When by the time the game got rolling, you know, midway through the first quarter, it's like, wait a minute, this isn't quite that. And so I think for me, where the wind really got taken out of my sails was when Gary got kicked out of the game, because I kind of felt like he was the one player out there that kind of had that edge about him. And it was almost to the point of you wanted him to back it down a little bit. It, honestly, for anybody that remembers him, it gave me, before he got kicked out, just seeing how he was talking to some of the other players and stuff, it reminded me a little bit of Robert Killebrew.
I knew you were going
to
say that.
You always had to kind of like dial him in a little bit, but you know, he was out there headbutting people on his team and the other team and, you know, talking noise back and forth. But that's kind of what you want out of your linebackers. You know, you want somebody that's spitting nails. And so you kind of saw that from him. And when he, you know, got hit with the targeting call, which I think was the right call, that's when I kind of got really worried because we're already shorthanded there. So
I wondered at the time if that was the moment, you know, I always like to tell like the Tony Romo Dallas Cowboy deal, yeah, where when Tony throws four interceptions in the first quarter, but the game is like 13-0. So you're not out of it.
Right.
But when the game's over, you look back on it and you lose by six, yeah, and you go, in the end, that was the moment when we just weren't going to survive that. And I felt that way when Gary was knocked out. I felt like when we look back on this game, I wonder if we're going to say the moment they lost that guy, who might be their best defensive player and, you know, for a defense, I think needed a ringleader of sorts, not having him. I think they just guessed on personnel at a lot of occasions on that game, and they got caught sometimes.
And this is kind of an aside, but one of the weirder things to me, maybe weird is not the right word, but I use this word in our little group chat. I flat out said, like, what was kind of underwhelming to me was the selection of the captains. So, and I don't know how else to describe it other than just like the guys that I was around that were captains were badasses. You know, like you had your Casey Studdards and your Lyle Sinline, Justin.
Who were the captains of the 05 team?
Don't get me lying. I want to say David Thomas was one of them.
That he has.
I'm pretty sure Casey was one of them.
Maybe Lyle.
We probably had a few seniors on there. And I don't even know if we did it where it was senior. I don't know if we did it where it was captains for the whole season. Like, I think, I want to say we had it where there was captains per game. But it just always felt like those guys were, like, the right guys.
But they don't have guys like that.
I don't think they do. And that's, and it's tough to say that because, you know, kind of, like I said, it's hard for me because I know what they go through. I mean, they're putting in work, so yeah. I'm not at all trying to disparage that. But it just felt like when I was looking to the field as that game was progressing and you're looking to find where those captains are, it wasn't the people I expected. I figured it would be Chris Boyd. I figured it would be Gary Johnson. Because I figured those are the guys where in the heat of the moment, they're probably getting the team right. You know,
you
they're getting in somebody
else.
You want
your best players to be your best leaders. Exactly. If at all possible. Right.
And I don't know. I just, when I saw, you know, like Elijah Rodriguez and I figured Chris Nelson would be. So that made kind of sense. But still, it was kind of guys that, you know, are I think more of the lead by action kind of guys, you know, and I'm not a big rah-rah person either. You know, I'm not in it for the sake of you give speeches just to give them, but you want to be able to turn to somebody on your field and know that, okay, things start going a little bit south. We can look to this person to steady it. And I don't think they have that guy.
I was thinking about this earlier today. It's completely different because when you arrived at Texas with your recruiting class, the teams were good. Right. Mm-hmm. Like you guys didn't walk into this situation, but what the program had a reputation for at the time was that it wasn't beating Oklahoma. And there was a weird softness label that kept coming with Texas, yeah. Which was really weird because Texas was winning 10 and 11 games a year. And, you know, they were in 2001, the year before you show up right there on the cusp, yeah, of. They win that Big 12 championship game. They're playing in a national championship game against Miami. And I think maybe the narrative is different when you guys, right, show up. But when y'all showed up, you guys, even as good as you guys were, there was still some butt kickings that had to take place. Y'all, yep, still took it on the chin from Oklahoma. You still had the Arkansas game happen. You, yeah, still had Washington State happen, right? And so there's this moment where you guys have this reputation of not being deal closers. And I don't know when it happened. I don't know what moment when I look back on it and say it changed. Maybe it was in the Rose Bowl and maybe that game changed it. Because I know the next year you guys all just had a different air about you. But there got to be a moment somewhere along the way where you guys crossed a mental barrier, so much so that by the time y'all got to Oklahoma in 05, it wasn't, y'all hadn't beaten them in 5 years, and there was, yeah, never any doubt that week that Texas was going to beat Oklahoma. Y'all routed them, and it was like, oh, that was no big deal. Like, I wonder, because this is where this team is. This team has to make a mental jump and cross this barrier of where they are now. And I wonder, even though you haven't gone through exactly this exact thing they're going from, but you guys were slotted in a place and deemed to be one thing. And, right, the reason why people remember you guys is because you ultimately lifted the program beyond the state that you arrived in into this new rarefied air, which it kept for half a decade.
Yeah.
What do you see from this group from an attitude standpoint that, because I don't have the answer. Like, I look at it and I don't know what to tell a Texas fan what was wrong about Saturday.
Yeah, it's tough. And you and I have talked about this privately before, and it's something that I don't have as much insight into. You probably even have more than I do. But the thing that we mentally, from an edge perspective, I feel like we always had on our opponents was the work we had already put in. And for us, after that Michigan Rose Bowl, we knew what we wanted the next year, which was the national championship. And so everybody's heard about Vince writing it on the wall, you know, writing it on the whiteboard in the locker room, you know, be here at 7 o'clock at the, you know, at the Denny's practice fields if you want to win a national championship. That happened and everybody showed up. And that's where we kind of like molded ourselves and we pushed ourselves because our coaches weren't there. We could curse each other out. We could fight if we had to. We could do whatever we had to do to kind of mold and shape that team. That's where our leaders were built. And that's where all of our hardest work came in, I think, where nobody else was really watching, where nobody else was holding us accountable but your brother to your left and to your right. And so then when we got back into Mad Dog's hands, people have given him hell over the years, but the one thing we were always ready to do was dominate in the fourth quarter. And you see every team across the country, when it came fourth quarter, they hold the four, you know, the four fingers up and wave them in the air. But it was one of those deals where, like, we were looking forward to the fourth quarter because we had pounded on each other so much that we knew there couldn't be anything in a game tougher than what we'd already put ourselves through.
Doesn't every team, though, think they've worked as hard? Like, in high school, as an athlete, right, I was just an average athlete.
Yeah.
I thought I worked really hard. And then as I got into this business and I would get around championship programs like Austin Westlake or stuff like that, mm-hmm. and I would watch their guys, I would go, oh.
Yeah.
I wasn't actually doing that.
And I think the best I can put it is when you have a collection of guys that don't need someone else to motivate you to do it. It doesn't take a coach giving you a speech. It's literally you are concerned about letting one of your boys down. Like, I mean, these become your brothers. You spend more time with them than you do your family, your girlfriend, your friends. I mean, more time than you are, you know, at school in most instances. I mean, you literally do everything with them. And so it became a thing where, like, I didn't want to get clowned by the next guy. I was less concerned about how is Marcus going to look or how is, you know, VY is less concerned about how is VY going to look. We're concerned about, are we going to put something on tape that we're going to get clowned by our boys about? And not our boys back home, but our boys that we're in there grinding with. And so I think somehow that's the edge that they're missing. And part of it is, I don't know if it's taught. I don't know if it can be coached. It's just you either have it or you don't. And it wasn't like I was some superstar on the team, but I knew I put in enough work going up against the guys I went against that when Saturday came, I wasn't really worried about anything else because I knew the assignments that I had on special teams or if I need to go out and make a block. I was going against Derek Johnson when I was a freshman. So, okay, true story. This is where I'll get on tangents, right? Like, my freshman year at Texas, I ended up redshirting, but I was DJ's backup, so I traveled most of the games because if he were to get hurt, I would have had to burn my shirt. But my very first practice was they used to do it where the freshmen were separate, right? So the freshmen came in, you practiced just freshmen. For a couple of days, yeah. But then, and so we had five linebackers in my recruiting class. It was myself, Garnett Smith, Aaron Harris, Michael Williams from Lindale, and then Brian Robinson, who just now ended up hanging it up. And so my very first practice, though, our coach was Carl Reese. Everybody called him Bull. And the very first thing he did in that practice was we did Bull in a Ring, where, you know, if you remember, everybody circles up. So all the linebackers would circle up, and he would call somebody to the middle. And then you're just two guys charging at each other, and it's basically like, who was going to be man enough to remain standing? My very first practice, he sent DJ at me like six times in a row. Now, this dude was, you know, he had just come off like a freshman All-American campaign. He was four or five star. I mean, he's literally the greatest linebacker I've ever played with. And it's in part why just being around him, I felt sorry that people were putting that much on Malik when he was here because it was just an unfair comparison. I mean, the guy was just a total badass. And I mean, he knocked me.
All these years later, there still hasn't been another.
There hasn't Johnson. Been, and he's still playing, right? I mean, that's the crazy thing. He may have lost a step, but he's still out there playing in the NFL. He's the Chiefs' all-time leading tackler. You think about the guys that they've had, and this is the guy that I got to go against my first day of practice. But I knew if I could manage to hold my own against him, who else in the nation was really going to come close to that? From whether it was a fullback or a linebacker, there wasn't anybody else. And so there was something about that having guys before you that you knew were at the top of their game. When I was a true freshman, the seniors were Corey Redding and Chris Sims, right? So DJ was just a sophomore, but we had Corey Redding showing us the ropes. We had, at the time, Casey Hampton and Big Sean coming back during the spring and, you know, talking noise to us if we didn't know, you know, what was going on out there. So we had guys that had achieved it at the highest levels showing us the ropes. And there's some of that, but I mean, I just don't know if they've had the leadership at those levels to show them that when it gets the toughest, this is how you dig out of it. And it almost felt like on Saturday, they were all kind of looking around like, okay, who's going to make the play? Instead of there being a guy saying, I'm going to be the one to make the play. The ones that almost seemed the most ready were the freshmen. Now, they made some mistakes, but it was almost like they didn't know any better. Yeah, so you looked up, and at some point, you know, I don't know the schemes, so I can't claim to know what they were doing, when, and why. But you look up, and at one point, the sweep was non-existent because B.J. Foster's out there just running it down. And it's almost like, well, this is what I know. I know to go chase the ball, so I'm going to do that, and I'm going to do it at a million miles an hour, and I'm going to have an attitude when I get there. And so, you know, it seems like they're starting to get some of that talent back, but there's still some of just that wait around, wait and see who's going to make the play instead of multiple guys stepping up and saying it's going to be me. And you'd want that to be your quarterback. That's what we were blessed with, right? We had, was that an 8-9 year run of VY and Colt back to back? So,
I mean, think about this. I don't know if enough people know this. You know, Miami had probably is most notorious for like their long stretch of great quarterback play, right? Because it would start with Cozar and kind of went all the way through the 80s. And even guys like Steve Walsh, right, or Gino Toretta, you know, let alone Vinny Testaverde and Jim Kelly and some of the guys that they had. But Texas started in 94, gets 4 years of James Brown.
Yep.
He hands the baton off to Major, and you get 4 years of Major mixed in with 4 years of Chris.
Right.
And those two guys, there's a one-year anomaly where the handoff between Chris in 2002, ultimately to VY next, is kind of bridged where Chance.
Yeah.
And Chance had a 17-1 touchdown to interception ratio, and the bar was so high in this place that, you know, it wasn't good enough. It was like, well, that's good, and the stats look good, but the eyeball tells us that we need something else. And so then you have one weird year where they'd kill to have Chance Mock right now, and then you get VY, and then you get Colt McCoy. So you go from 1994 to 2009. Every guy that follows the other one is arguably, if not the best quarterback in school history. The next guy is the best, arguably, because JB was that. James Brown was the best quarterback since James Street, the best quarterback in the modern era. I would still say that James was better than Major, but Chris Sims, those two guys elevated their plays up. Then you hand it off to Vince, who's an alien who we've never seen before. And then Colt McCoy ends up being a guy who gets his number retired. And then they're in this decade stretch. It's like they regress back to the mean.
Yeah.
And it's just hard. Like
every one of them was the unquestioned leader of their side of the ball. And most of the, I get the years mixed up. You probably know it better than me, but you think about James was probably the same time as Casey and Sean, right? So they're the unquestioned leaders of the defensive side of the ball. So you had these rock solid guys that not only on the field, but in the locker room, everybody looked to and knew that these guys were about their business and this is the way we were going to go about it. It's like I said, when I came in as a true freshman, those guys were Chris Sims and Corey Redding. I mean, so what, they were both the parade All-Americans when they came in. And so it was just one handoff from the next, not only from the quarterback position, but on the defensive side of the ball, where there were true alphas on each side of the ball that were kind of unquestioned. And then you had your mix in of guys, you had your Brett, your Ungars and your, you know, your, gosh, his name, Bo Trahans, and just, you know, these special teams gurus. So like every aspect of what we came into in 2002, was kind of covered. You know, we knew everything was that important. And I just feel like it's kind of like you said, like, I never really thought of it that it was that long of a stretch of quarterback play that was that good. But with it came all that leadership. And so you just haven't seen that. I don't know if it's from a confidence thing of not winning, of not, you know, putting together the on-field performances that they wanted to have. But it just seems lacking.
I had a conversation with Justin Blaylock the summer of 2005. So it's in the middle of all of the workouts that ultimately lead to, I think, the preparations for that Ohio State game were really forged in that summertime. You could see the team getting ready for that moment. And I remember walking up to Blaylock on the sidelines of just a random practice. And it might have been like right when the preseason polls had come out. Mm-hmm. And I was like, hey, man, I was like, I'm getting ready to, I don't know. I had to turn in a prediction or something like that. And I said, hey, who's your preseason number one? Who do you think's winning the national championship this year? You know, and Blaylock gave it a total, he really gave it a long, thoughtful answer. And he's like, well, you know, USC, and they've got really good players. And he kind of went through it all. And he was like, and Ohio State's really good. And then he just stopped and he goes, look, man, here's my answer. The team that wins a national championship is going to be the guy that has that guy playing for it. And he pointed to Vince and he goes, you tell me, who's he playing for this year? And I was like, Texas. And he was like, well, then that's the team that's going to win the national championship because only one team has that guy. And I think that Oklahoma's probably, their players probably felt that way about Baker.
Yeah.
I think the Clemson guys would have felt that way about Deshaun Watson. I think they probably feel that guy about their guys now. I think the one ugly truth about the program right now, and you saw it again on Saturday, and I don't take this as a shot to Sam or anybody that's there. Mm-hmm. They're not at a point yet. When it gets really, really tough, you just know. Like you guys would have done in Oklahoma State, right? When it was like, hey, forget about what the score of the game is. That dude is going to make sure we're okay.
Yeah.
And I think on Saturday when I watched this team, that was part of what was apparent is that they're still looking around at each other to say, who's the guy that's going to make it okay for us? And it's easier said than done. It's like, oh, it's just the quarterback. I mean, it didn't happen for VY right away. Like, it didn't happen for Colt right away. It didn't happen for Sims right away. It didn't even happen for James Brown all the way. Like, all of these guys go through this testing period. And I wonder if Texas is still in the middle of a testing period and we're just too impatient for it because we're 9 years, 8 years into this thing now.
So that's where I fight with myself, right? Because the fan, Marcus, says, why is it taking Texas 8 or 9 years to find a quarterback? You know? Now, I get on the other side of that, having been through it and seen it, it's not that simple. But maybe I'm just, being too small-minded about this. I just feel like everybody else is finding a quarterback. You know, I'm – or at least a quarterback that can have success within the system that they are putting in place. And one of the things I'm struggling with is I don't know what we're trying to do. I try to like tell myself a story of, okay, this is what we're going with. And then something will work and we'll go away from it. Right. So I hadn't gone back to watch the game again yet because I had to give myself like I was.
You haven't even gotten there yet.
I was legit depressed. I'll tell you this much. You know, I've been on Orange Buds for years. Yeah. Back to from when you were covering me when I was in high school. I haven't logged in. Haven't gone back and looked.
People are on tilt, man.
I can't because it baffles me. Like some of the decisions that we make, and like I said, I haven't gone back and watched it again. But just watching it from being there, I felt like when I was watching Keontae Ingram get the ball, when I was watching Trey Watson get the ball, I was like, okay, we got something here. And then he does a perfect cutback, line blocks it up perfectly, scores a touchdown. And if I saw him if he got the ball another time for the rest of the game, I missed it. And that just threw me off. So then I go look at the box score and I see he only had 6 carries. And I'm just like,
If this you could tweak one thing on offense, what would you do if they put the coaching hat on you this week?
I would have just kept running it. I mean, at least that was something that felt like we were having success with. And it even seemed like Sam was reluctant to run it. You know, it felt like a couple of times he had 10, 15 yards in front of him. And I don't know if he was being told not to. I don't know if he was consciously saying to himself, I want to prove I can throw it. I don't know what it was, but it just felt like there was things there for the taking on the ground that we turned away from. And if you looked at it, that's how they were opening things up for our defense or against our defense initially, is they were running it. They're running some of these jet sweeps. They're running it up the middle. And it's not always, you know, perfect. It's not always, you know, 5-6 yards, but 3 here, 4 there, it chips away.
You could feel them kind of rope-a-doping Texas. Yeah. Swinging the ball back and forth across the field. And then
definitely,
you could just sense like
it's coming.
They've got this thing loosened up, and now it's a matter of, you know, Texas at this point is completely leery of the entire field.
Yeah.
And it wasn't an accident when Maryland, I felt like they scripted early in the game.
Yeah.
You know, when you watch an NFL game and they talk about, we script our first 15 plays. And usually it looks, you in the NFL, if Aaron Rodgers has scripted 15 plays, it looks like it. You're like, oh.
Yeah.
It looked like Maryland scripted their offense early, did exactly what they wanted to do, and Texas set it up perfectly for them, as opposed to it didn't look like it looked, you know, I hate to throw the out coach thing out there because that's almost it. Sometimes it's hard to say if a guy's been out anything is tough to judge at times, but it looked like Maryland was getting from Texas exactly what it wanted and what it was expecting on that side of the ball.
Yeah.
And I felt like Texas, let me ask you this, because this is something that Tom talks about a lot with this team, but I feel like this is something that coaches say a lot now. This idea of the other team took something away from us, so we're going to take the things that it gives us offensively when they take things away from us. And I feel like when you're really good, you just impose your will.
That's the phrase I was thinking of this whole time, because I mean, that's exactly it. You can stack the box and you can make it harder to run. But if man on man, I'm whooping the guy in front of me across that line and we're moving the line of scrimmage, you're not going to be able to continue to take it from me. And if you do, that means that you're leaving everything else open. Well, Sam would drop back sometimes and there was nobody open. He would drop back sometimes and you missed the guy that was open. So it's hard for me to just go with you give what the defense takes you. Because when I saw this thing humming at its best, nobody took anything from us. They tried to, but we imposed our will. And like I said, I mean, you know, like some of these guys I play with were a little crazy, right? And on some level, I also think that that's what's missing, but that's probably a whole nother conversation I can go off on a tangent about.
How many crazy guys do you think you had in the locker room at Texas? Legitimate crazy guys. Because I think they're all nice kids now.
Yeah, they are. So where I was going with this, I couldn't give you a number. I know it was enough for it to be significant. I need hands and toes. You know, I need fingers and toes to count them up.
Yeah.
But it was like a controlled crazy. Casey Studdard was a nut. And I loved him for it. Sometimes we would be out there and Casey would tell the opposing team where we were about to run the ball. He would literally point. He wasn't just pointing, you know, like you point and the center's, you know, identifying the mic. I've heard Casey tell the other team, we're about to run the ball right here and there's nothing you can do about it. And he didn't say it in those kind of words. He used a little more colorful language when he said it, but they knew where the ball was going and they couldn't stop us. So when I hear you get what you take what the defense gives you, I get that to a point. I do. But I think if you establish an identity that you are going to be so nasty up front. My dad went to Texas Tech and he played football there. He tolerated me being at UT. The second I was gone, he was back to his black and red. he doesn't root against Texas, but he says all the time, unless we have big nasties up front on both sides of the ball, we're going to struggle. And I can't say I can argue with him. You know, I feel like everybody along that offensive line are just, I don't know how to say it, they're really nice guys. And I'm not saying I want a team full of goons. I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with being a nice guy, but there's something to be said for, you don't like the limelight. Yeah, a good mix of guys that football is so important to them and they're tough. It's not just about, I mean, you know, that they're willing to grind it out through injuries. And that's not to say that these guys aren't. It's just there's something you see about certain offensive lines, whether you're looking in the NFL or in college. You're just like, okay, those guys are kind of nasty. You know, they you know, that you look at them, they look like they're snarling almost, right? They're moving guys off the ball. I mean, you're literally moving another human. That's what you lift all that weight for. So the number increases of the strength gains that they've had, that's all impressive, but it doesn't mean a damn thing to me if you can't move the guy in front of you when the ball snapped on Saturday. And while I will say, though, I felt like the offensive line was improved. I didn't see like a whole lot of tackles for loss or anything like that. So I think they're going in the right direction there, but it still doesn't seem like they're just imposing their will.
Who's your favorite player on this team so far?
Oh, man. Gary's my favorite, but I think I haven't seen enough of him this year to really be able to continue to say that. I really like Chris Boyd. I like how he plays. He plays with kind of the mentality of the DBs I've used to being around when DBU was DBU.
I feel like he could have played with that group.
Yeah. Yeah. I think he would have fit in well with them.
I think those guys with Twitter back in the day might have been interesting. I'm trying to imagine that group back then.
It would have been them getting captured doing stuff more than it would have been them being active. Yes. Right. So, you know, we had some characters on our team, and so we had some close calls, and we had some calls that got caught up on and all kinds of stuff. But I don't think we would have been, and I think this is something we've talked about, it's just a different time. That's what this generation likes to do. You know, they came up being on Twitter, on Instagram, and kind of interacting with their friends that way.
But all the programs now have that. Like, you know what I mean? Like,
that's true.
Oklahoma's figuring out a way to make it happen, and TCU and all of the programs. Like, it's weird to see Texas just be – they're just weird. Texas is a weird football program.
It is. The thing that let me know that I was truly in a different time and I was quote-unquote getting old was I don't follow recruiting a whole lot. I kind of wait until it gets close to signing day and then I try to get myself up to speed enough. But following the recruitment of Calvin Anderson, like I don't have a lot of hair, but like the little I had, I wanted to pull out because I'm thinking this is supposed to be like our savior left tackle. And I see him every day on Instagram or Twitter with, you know, posing for a picture with another coach. And like, that's a nice thing.
My lawn guy.
Yeah. Like that's a nice thing to do, but like, I couldn't ever picture Casey or Lyle or Justin Blaylock or Jonathan Scott or any of those guys doing that, you know? And I just had to tell myself, like, this is what these kids do. They announce their recruitments and they do these videos and they make an announcement of just cutting down from 50 to 15 teams. And like, this is just what it is. But I don't know, man. I just, some of those aspects are when I say, okay, I don't know if some of these guys could have made it when we were playing. And I think every kind of generation does that. So I'm aware enough to know.
You definitely are turning a little bit into
that
guy.
But I'm turning into the old guy.
But at least you're doing that. You always have the fallback of the trump card is you guys want it all.
Yeah.
So if someone wants to say, oh, get out of here with that, we couldn't have played back there on that team. It's like, well, just so you know, we might have actually been the greatest college football team of all time. Yeah. Like, we're in that breath. I've got two questions to ask you.
For sure.
And then whatever, before we wrap up, whatever else is on the Marcus docket will get out. Who is the biggest former player fanatic in terms of if they go to a game, they are so into it. You know, just that is that you? Because you said you're vocal. Is there anybody that goes to the game?
I've dialed it back. I've watched a couple games with Casey, and he can get pretty riled up.
It's all personal to him.
Yeah, like, yeah, because a lot of the stuff I'm trying to describe, like, for him, it's to a whole different level.
I can only imagine.
Like, he can't even fathom, like, coming out of a game or, you know, not just knocking somebody off the ball. So I'd say it's pretty intense watching one with him.
What about in your group chat? Is there anybody that's who's the biggest smack talker, even if they're not UT related?
One of my best friends, he's a guy that went to UT. We call him, his name's Derek, but we all call him Big D. So he's a real big guy. But I love him to death, man. He took me under his wing when I got to Texas. And he played offensive line when he was in high school. So, you know, he kind of prides himself on watching the offensive line and being able to tell you. And more times than not, he's right. You know, it's very, very few times where he's off the mark. But right now he's pretty devastated because he thought he had this team pretty much pegged. He was drinking the Kool-Aid. He thought we were ready to go on a run this year. And he was saying today that, you know, he was wrong. And so I think that's all of us are, we're kind of having to tuck our tails a little bit. And I think we all just want to get back to the point where things are rolling again and it feels good. And we can talk a little smack and I can, like.
You got to get Big D on your podcast.
I'm going to get him out here for sure. I'm going to get some of the guys from the group chat on there. There's some guys.
It's therapy, man. You'll be able to tell them, you know what? I've been feeling bad, but I talked it out of my system a little bit.
The funny thing is, I mean, in between, you know, in our downtime during the day, while we're all working and stuff, it's kind of our outlet, you know, to go. And we know it's all family in there versus being somewhere else in a group of people where, you know, people went to different schools and we got to bite our tongue when they take their pot shots at Texas because it hurts. But they're right more times than not these days. So.
Anything left that you want to get out in this first podcast? I've enjoyed it.
I have too. It's gone a lot quicker than I thought. You know, I think I just want to use this kind of as a medium to be able to talk through different things that are on my mind. I listen to podcasts all the time. That's kind of the best medium these days, in my opinion, for conversation and just hearing things that you want to hear. There's enough in the world out there that, you know, you don't want to hear and all the political rhetoric and all these kinds of things that have people divided these days. But one of the things that has always helped me, you know, just come together with everyone is sport. And so just wanted to find a way where I could kind of get out here, talk through some of these ideas and thoughts. And like you said, have a little therapy session here and there that I don't necessarily have to pay for and just kind of see where this thing goes. But I'm looking forward to get some of my old teammates on here. You know, some of the fans that I know are, you know, really into the sport and the game, and then just, you know, kind of taking some of these different ideas that come off the field as well. And that's kind of where the idea of Until the Whistle came is, you know, you're always told to play until the whistle. And I figure, you know, I could kind of do a play on words with that where, you know, this thing can go until the whistle, but then some of the thoughts that it spurs can go a little bit beyond that. And the next time the whistle blows, get back at it.
I think it's been a good, great first edition. I can't wait. Eventually, you'll just be flying and you won't need me. So I'll just turn into a big fan like everybody else. Thanks to everybody at the Yak for giving us this platform to give Marcus this initial podcast. And where it goes from here is going to be a lot of fun. Until next time, I'll close this out. Marcus, we'll see you next week.
All right. Sounds great. Thanks.